Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, and today I am really pleased to welcome Adam Werbach as our guest. Adam has been one of the most visible standard bearers for the environmental and sustainable commerce movements over the past 20 years. At the tender young age of 23, he was elected national president of the Sierra Club. He later formed Act Now Productions, a consulting firm that helped both nonprofits and major corporations such as Cisco and Procter & Gamble go green. We're going to find out what that means. Act Now was eventually rolled up into Saatchi & Saatchi, which allowed Adam to scale his global sustainability efforts across 80 countries. He is now CEO of Yertle, a startup for giving away things to people you know or getting things you need from them. On today's program, we're going to discuss the future of sustainable business. What does sustainability really mean? What are the key success requirements? Are there any? And what models show the most promise today? Adam, it's a real pleasure having you on our show.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Chris.
You have a very accomplished resume for someone who's not even 40 yet. Can you give our listeners a quick background how you came to the sustainability movement? I think what I'm really interested in here is how did you come to choose this as your life's focus?
Well, I guess it was a number of choices over a period of time, but I first got involved, I was really a little kid. I remember in second grade, I somehow found a petition to oust James Watt, who is the Secretary of the Interior under Ronald Reagan.
I remember him, yeah.
The Sierra Club was sending these petitions to everyone, and I just saw it on my parents' table, and it said, sign your name, and we were kind of working on our cursive that day, so I brought it in for show and tell and had signed my name and asked my friends to sign their names. And it actually felt pretty good. The teacher was, I guess, some sort of hippie, too, so she was into the idea and had me go walk around the rest of the school and get signatures. I collected like 200 or 300 signatures, and we sent them in. And those joined together with about a million other signatures, and eventually James Watt was ousted. So I think from a very early age, I got a sense that you could actually do something, even if you were very young. You could be effective. And that tied with just a real love of nature and seeing it. I grew up in Southern California, so just living in smog-laden days and watching the kind of the nature behind my house be destroyed, I think primed me to do something about this.
Yeah, I certainly share the same sort of an upbringing. One of the things that I've noticed over here in the East is one of my practices is if I ever am driving on the road and I see a turtle, I will stop and put it in whatever direction it's facing on the other side of the road. And it's been about 10 years since I've stopped, not because I've lost interest in turtles, but I haven't seen them anymore. And so I share with you the sense that in my own short life, relatively speaking, there have been extraordinary changes that have come about. This is interesting. So you get into the world of sustainability. How is it that you came to be leading the Sierra Club at such a young age? What happened there?
Well, I kept on with little bits of activism. And in high school, I started a group of high school students just working on environmental issues in Southern California. And we eventually hooked up with the Sierra Club and asked their Los Angeles chapter if we could help, kind of organize students for them. And that idea just kind of spread. So we had what was called the Sierra Student Coalition. And in about a year after we started it, we had 30,000 students across the country just organizing on issues in their own neighborhoods, from lead poisoning to air pollution to nature preservation. And again, it was kind of very, very grassroots and very informal. This is sort of the dawn of electronic communication and using BBSs and all sorts of things to spread the word. And when we all sort of graduated high school and went to college, we took the ideas to our colleges, and it sort of spread from there. The Sierra Club actually tried to shut us down, which is the response to all small internal revolutions. Through some foresight by some of the older members of the board of directors, they decided instead not to shut us down, but to adopt us as this student arm of the Sierra Club and put me on the board. And a few years later, with the support of David Brower, who is kind of a legendary environmentalist, I became the president of the organization.
And how long did you remain as president?
Oh, I did two terms, so a couple years. That was enough.
All right. Well, in 2004, you presented a then-controversial speech titled The Death of Environmentalism and the Birth of the Commons Movement. I believe you presented that at the Commonwealth Club. which challenged the environmental establishment to adopt a completely different approach and start linking its goals with other broad social and economic goals. What really led you to conclude that there was some seismic shifts were needed in the movement?
Well, I believe everything we know about climate change today, we knew 20 years ago, probably knew 30 years ago. I mean, we know it in more detail now, but we know that this is an existential challenge to humanity, to our culture and the way we're living, and we therefore need to organize our politics around trying to stop it. And the one movement that's sort of set up and funded and that sort of bears responsibility as much as we can to do something about it is the environmental movement. But even though, you know, I spent my entire life in it, the truth is we've done very, very little. We have not moved the ball. And, you know, I had this experience in 2003, 2004, kind of right after the Kerry election, or the failure of to elect John Kerry, of talking to all of my colleagues in the environmental movement and saying, what's your realistic plan for just slowing even the rate of climate change? And everyone kind of laughed. They said that's unreasonable to think about right now because we're just trying to build political will and political momentum. And what I concluded at the time was that really the frame of environmentalism that was born in the 1970s, where you would use science to identify a problem like air pollution or water pollution, then you would use government regulation or laws to actually stop it, so Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and then you would litigate if people violated it, which really worked in the 1970s, that framework wouldn't work against climate change. And we have to do something completely different to grab the sort of public support that we need to pass major climate change legislation or, frankly, change the way we live to be able to survive on a warming planet.
So are you saying that the political arena is not the right way to tackle certain things, or is the political arena really lost a lot of its capability or capacity to effectively mitigate today's predicaments and problems?
Well, I don't think we can opt out of politics, and I continue to believe that's absolutely critical. You know, for those of us who you know are tuned into these issues and understand that we need to protect our families and our communities, we still have a responsibility to organize the body politic. But it's not enough, and particularly around the time of 2004, that you know the last decade, we saw the Bush administration be completely reticent about any change. And, you know, the reason I started working with big companies was because that was an arena where companies were actually, you know, have actually kind of totally separated from the kind of Republican Party dogma that climate change is a hoax. They understand this thing that they have to plan for that's affecting their supply chains already. And they actually were ready to move forward even though the government politics was not. So, you know, the change for me was to say, let's go find a different arena and work in that one because, not that politics isn't important, but there just was no forward progress that was happening there.
Well, and a lot of the frontline decisions, such as they are, being made at the corporate levels anyway, this is where actions and monies and materials are all being dedicated to getting one outcome or another. So there's quite a bit of action there, I guess.
That's right. And there was, I mean, again, before 2004, 2005, there was an ideological wall between corporations and the environmental movement where companies would actually choose not to take an action that would make them more productive or increase the efficiency of their supply chain or make their products better because it seemed to be wrapped up in the sort of green dogma and they didn't want any part of that. And, you know, truthfully, I think the moment that, you know, at least I point to as kind of a critical moment was the moment when Walmart, which is, you know, obviously the king of companies and supply chain with 60,000 suppliers across the world, really said this isn't some crazy stuff from the West Coast. It's a way for us to save money for our consumers, for our customers. And, you know, and they basically said we expect all of our suppliers to do the same. And that, just like a light bulb going off, flipped the switch. And, you know, for the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, what we've seen since then is really just this leap forward among companies embracing efficiencies throughout their supply chain. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but that really didn't exist, at least in the way we've seen it before that time.
Great. You know, I'm really fascinated to get to how specifically companies are embracing all of this in large measure because I believe that the environmental movement has, in some cases, framed itself as in opposition to business. And it's always struck me that, in fact, framed the right way, business and environmentalism are actually on the same side of the playing field and ought to be, you know, less adversarial and more aligned in some ways. And before we get to that discussion, then, let me just be really honest here. I'm not really a fan of the word sustainable at this point or any of its derivatives because I think it's a little vague. And it implies a lot but delivers little, such as in Europe now, I keep reading about sustainable growth, which feels like an oxymoron to me. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I wrote a book called Strategy for Sustainability. So I do actually have affection for the word, but I absolutely agree with your critique of it. Here's the transition we've sort of seen. We had environmentalism as the framework for that set of things necessary, those actions necessary to protect the Earth. And what ended up happening, one of the reasons why companies in particular and so many institutions weren't able to adopt environmentalism was it was largely a kind of a political or ideological goal set that wasn't actionable by them. The broad term of sustainability, at least in a business context, has four components: social, economic, environmental, and cultural. So instead of just thinking about how does this action protect the environment, the question is, how does this action make my enterprise more sustainable? How does it actually push culture, the culture in the company, inside and out? How does it actually move that? How does it move the economics of the initiative we're looking for? Does it save me money? Does it lower my bottom? Does it, you know, increase my bottom line? What is it doing for society? And what does it do for the environment? How do we blend all those things together? And in the context that I use it, sustainability in a business context really means long-term profitability. It means the ability of an enterprise to continue into the long term, which is, you know, kind of has been the missing link among the way that many businesses have been operated in the United States, in particular, which has sort of, frankly, been one of the kind of core reasons why we've seen sort of this quarterly profit push that's built not a lot of value for shareholders, and also had these sort of negative externalities that we see in terms of the environment.
Well, I'm very interested now to hear about the ways in which this thinking has shifted in companies. I heard a couple of maybe hints there that some of these things play well on the bottom line, which is, of course, always a win for business. But you mentioned that there are four big pieces here. You've got social, you've got economic, political, cultural. Let's talk about, I believe soon after you started consulting, Walmart was one of your early companies, and the company was then viewed, I think, as one of the non-greenest, least sustainable corporate juggernauts, at least conventionally out there in the press. First of all, what did you find? What sort of reception did you receive, and how successful would you judge their efforts so far? What's really transpired there?
Well, I think that the biggest gift that Walmart has given to the environmental or sustainability movement is legitimizing this as an active field of business play. So, you know, when Walmart made a commitment in 2004, 2005 to do three things: one, to be powered 100% by renewable energy; two, to produce zero waste; and three, to stock items on their shelves that would sustain the Earth's resources, which were pretty kind of mouth-dropping commitments at the time. And frankly, they just sort of caused a lot of laughter in the environmental movement from a lot of my colleagues. Walmart approached me about helping with those, and I mean, truthfully, I thought they were kidding until I saw that actually, you know, they really plugged this all into the challenges they were trying to do to refashion the company. You know, basically, after Sam Walton, the charismatic founder, had passed away, Walmart had been searching for a way to have that same sort of passion that he had inspired in the company. And they, you know, kind of wisely understood between the chairman of the board, Rob Walton, and the CEO at the time, Lee Scott, that they could use sustainability as a way to lower costs, take costs out of their supply chain, to re-engage their associates in a purpose greater than just the bottom line. They could actually have a kind of a way to push innovation through their own supply chain, which, you know, is a pretty bang up management tool for a leadership to use.
So it became a new set of guiding principles, or a higher guiding principle around which things get organized then.
That's right. And higher purpose.
Higher purpose. I love a higher purpose. In their case, how successful has this been? What are the real changes since they set those goals?
Can't walk into a Walmart or a Sam's Club and not see the changes. I mean, literally every single product in the Sam's Club has been touched by this, from a packaging change to ingredients change to less toxics. If you go to the back of a Walmart from what it looked like from the past, I mean, they've radically reduced the amount of waste coming out of the back of the store. I mean, they used to, you know, kind of pay to throw away cardboard. Now people pay them to take their cardboard away because it's a recycled resource. They have, you know, reduced bottle sizes on products. So, for example, Tide, the best, you know, the United States' best-selling detergent, they've reduced its package size radically, which means that they're shipping water, you know, a lot less water across the country as they sort of move it back and forth. You know, they've changed the design of their trucks to radically increase their fuel economy. They've, you know, banned some products that were toxic, even though they weren't banned by the government. They've worked on porous concrete in their parking lots to help water pollution. So, I mean, there's lots and lots of things. You know, the pause I'll say is I think that it's very admirable, and I think they've done some great things, and I'm really proud of the work that I've been able to do with them. But it's still not enough. And I don't mean to foreshadow our next part, but this is the same sort of feeling that I have about the environmental movement, unable to actually achieve its goal. I think, you know, sort of 7 or 8 or almost 10 years into this effort of corporate change, we've seen that there's a lot of great progress. There's now a lot of big companies and big consultants helping all these companies do it. But when we add it all together, Chris, it doesn't actually work to start dealing with the fact that, you know, we're watching turtles go extinct because of climate change. It doesn't actually add up to enough.
And that's a really important topic, and I'd love to get into it because in my own work, I am trying to shift a narrative that we happen to have. Mine happens to be more on the economic front, but I do wrap in a sense of the environment, both from a resource extraction standpoint, especially around non-renewable natural resources, also the waste streams going in. But I see that as a former biologist, there's something Liebig's minimum, which means that any organism can be successful up to whatever bottleneck material it needs or resource. And as I cast forward and I look at where we're headed in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, if I'm in a corporate position, I definitely, considering which industry I'm in, I really care about the idea that there are a number of critical non-renewable natural resources that are going to be fully depleted, at least in economic terms, under today's conditions. And this is because we've sort of ripped through them. And so I hear that there's a nibbling at the edges, increasing efficiency. This is all wonderful for this quarter, next year. That's wonderful. Where are we in the really, who's holding the big picture thinking about the fact that silver might be completely depleted within 20 years, or iridium is going to be difficult to come by, or any of these larger sort of resource issues, which say 7 billion going to 9 billion someday collides with a defined amount of stuff that we can get out of the crust of the earth.
And I think you're exactly on it. I mean, this is a calculation we need to do. We actually know that the population will level out, you know, people say 9, you know, I think the number is probably closer to 10 billion people around the year 2100. So that is our occupancy rate. Mm-hmm. That's how many people we need to plan for on the planet. We can, you know, argue about population control, or we can just sort of say, okay, there's going to be 10 billion people. How do we stretch our resources to be able to make sure that everyone there has a great quality of life? Here's the challenge, too, right? We're watching 3 or 4 billion people on the planet right now who do not have adequate access to the resources that we enjoy. So they don't have enough heating. They don't have enough shelter. They don't have enough clothing. They don't have the things that they should have and they deserve to have. As every human being does. So how do we radically kind of move them up the scale, the scale of Maslow's hierarchy, or just getting their basic needs met, mm-hmm. at the same time as kind of finding a way to match within these natural limits that we understand that we'll have, you know, by the year 2100? So there's a couple answers. I mean, one is, you know, that gets rejected by a lot of my environmental colleagues is technology. Technology is going to radically make our resources expand. Which is great, and that's something we need to invest in and embrace and really kind of understand. The second is really understanding how we live on this planet and what we actually need to live on this planet. You know, what's amazing is that while I mentioned the 3 or 4 billion people on the bottom of the scale, those of us who actually have plenty really have very poor skills on how to manage those things. So, for example, this year, the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, in their DSM, have added hoarding as the list of psychopathies, of disease, mental diseases that actually need to be treated among the American public, because it's a rapidly growing challenge. And what's kind of interesting is that hoarding, like obesity, reverse correlates to wealth. So the less money you have, the higher chance you have of being a hoarder, which only suggests that culturally we actually don't know what to do with all these things, that once we actually get access to them, and again, we have 3 or 4 more billion people who are going to be getting access to cheap goods that they'll be able to afford or get in the credit to do them, we just don't understand how to actually manage those. And we're actually finding that, that it's beginning to sort of bounce off of us. Sort of like your first time at the buffet, you just eat way too much before you understand, okay, it's going to be there, I can get a second plate, you know, I'll eat again. So that's the second piece, understanding actually how to live on this earth, how to live with a sense of limited resources, and how to kind of create a happy life within it. You know, and the third, truthfully, is a set of rules. We don't actually have the kind of network of rules to have so that we don't have cheaters on this planet. You know, there is only one atmosphere, and it doesn't matter if you live in China, the United States, or Turkey, you know, that's the same atmosphere. It doesn't matter where you release that CO2, we all have to pay for it. And a set of rules for that is, you know, something that we just need to come together with.
It's interesting, you know, just as a quick aside on hoarding, I'm wondering if the Psychiatric Association, certainly if you have National Geographic stacked roof to ceiling in your walking through corridors, they can define that as a psychopathy. What about the person who takes $3 billion and stashes in the Cayman Islands, way more than they could possibly ever use? Is that hoarding too, or do we define that differently? Is that success?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's an indelicate question that you need to ask, and we need to be asking. You know, there's a different view in Europe than there is in the United States on this. You know, there are limits to wealth in ways. You know, very delicate issues to talk about that we certainly aren't addressing in public discourse right now.
Oh no, absolutely. And so the thing that really catches me at this moment in time. So just to put this in context, we've all seen the pictures recently coming out of Beijing of their horrible air pollution problems. And so China's just gone through this extraordinary industrial revolution, sort of taking what probably took the United States 50 or 60 years, compress that into a 15 or 20 year timeline, and are paying now the same price that the United States paid back in the mid 70s when we figured this all out in terms of the cost of this. And so it gets back to this question of how do we go about really affecting and changing the narrative? Because I'm using that word sort of broadly, but when you say we have to find a way to live within our means, as it were, find a way to live, inhabit this planet of the Earth, it's going to require individual changes in terms of what's enough. It's going to require some broader cultural changes at the national levels and maybe even the global levels because we have one atmosphere. In terms of what have you found is the most effective way to change the narrative at any of those levels?
How do you change the narrative? I mean, I think truthfully, we have to just demonstrate that there is a better way to live. You know, it's aspirational as opposed to confrontational or penalizing people for living the wrong lifestyle. I mean, one of the reasons I've left Saatchi to launch this new retail idea called Yerdle, Yerdle, is to help people share things that they shouldn't have to buy. I mean, think about all the radical changes we've seen in the family. You know, fertility in the United States, you know, hovers around two, so two child per woman. Mm-hmm. And it's a little less than that, or heading towards there. But, you know, go back 100 years and it was much, much higher. We had big families and we knew how to share things between siblings. So things got passed down from sibling to sibling to sibling. Well, now with smaller families, we don't actually have those type of networks before. So people are, and meanwhile, we have retailers like Walmart and Amazon that make everything so cheap that it's much easier to buy something online than to borrow something. Mm-hmm. Even if that's not the best way to get it, even if it will cost you more money, and that doesn't really make sense. We just haven't adjusted our culture to having smaller family sizes, which is something that we need to do. I mean, think about China right now, right? So they've gone two generations of one-child policy. There are no aunts and uncles in China. There are no cousins in China.
Hmm.
I mean, the whole generations without aunts and uncles and cousins. And think about how rich and important your aunts and uncles, your cousins have been to growing up. Have we figured out what type of culture exists without them? You know, without them right now, what we're finding is that companies are stepping in and providing those services. Instead of a hand-me-down, they'll sell you something new. Instead of an experience at a park, you know, they'll sell you an amusement park. And figuring out how we actually build a more collective culture in this context is one of the kind of great challenges that we have. I mean, think about the United States. You know, so many of the traditions of making things that our grandparents had have been lost. You know, we had in the 1950s, you know, part of the kind of liberating women from the kitchen was allowing women not to have to make everything from scratch at that time. So you saw things like Bisquick and TV dinners made it very easy for women not to have to cook and make things from scratch. But forget women alone, but women and men now need to learn actually the skills again about how to actually make things. right? And that's a huge growth in that we're seeing growth trend in the U.S. This maker movement spurting up. If you go to kind of the urban hipster enclaves of Brooklyn or the Mission District in San Francisco, you'll see that makers are kind of the hot new thing, and that's a cultural bloom, an understanding of the type of skills that we need to live in this resource limited world where we actually need to learn how to fix things again instead of just throw them away. And that's when I talk about cultural sustainability, that's learning those skills of life that will allow us to survive both individually and as a community.
All right. I certainly am following along with this. One of the ideas, obviously, if we can use a shirt twice instead of once, we've just increased reduced its footprint by 50%, right?
And I have to say, this is the place where I got into a bit of craziness, where I was making shirts. I was helping, suppliers and companies make shirts 5% better, 10% better, organic wool, whatever it is. But they were being thrown away, right, after one quick use, or thrown down the supply chain, ideally to be upcycled at some point, as opposed to getting really circled up at a higher value for more time. And, that's one of the first things we should be doing, is making sure that the products that we have aren't sitting in our closets or aren't sitting in our garages, aren't sitting in our car trunks. They're actually being circulated. Not everyone needs to have one of everything.
I agree. And the thing that's caught me is that here's what I'd love to get some clarity from you, if I could. So I can identify things today, certain actions that we could take individually, say at the household level, that would be at once money saving for ourselves personally, deliver a higher quality of life, would reduce CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, would lower our use of fossil fuels, giving us more time to figure out how we transition to whatever that next energy future might be, which impacts national security, might even play into social justice in a positive way. There are all these things we could do. One simple example would be putting solar thermal panels on roofs where it makes sense to do that. It touches all of those things, and yet we don't do them typically. What are you really up against when you're trying to shift cultural use patterns, such as you're trying to do with Yertl?
Well, frankly, I think this is we just collectively haven't done it yet, so it's new. But I think this is I think this is completely inevitable. Resource productivity and basically making things work better. That's fun, and it just will happen. It just doesn't make sense to constantly make new things when the things we have are perfectly good. Doesn't make us happy. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't been done. So think about it. The formal economy in durable goods, from toasters to bicycles to camping equipment to kids' clothing to clothing, is about $1 trillion a year in the United States. About $1 trillion a year. But the informal market for that is much bigger. So that means every time that you borrow a tie from your dad, or you give maternity clothes to your sister, or you give a hand-me-down to someone else, or a neighbor borrows a shovel, that happens many, many more times than you go to a store. But it's decreasing, actually. Because of the sort of separation that we feel in the communities we live in, what we end up having is it's just easier to order something on Amazon.com than to ask a neighbor to see if they have it. Mm-hmm. But what we haven't seen is the same type of software, technology, and care, and marketing, frankly, to the informal economy as we've seen in the formal economy. So when we start, kind of having the same things you would expect to see when you went to Amazon.com, to know when it's available, to see a picture of it, to be able to get it delivered, with the things that you have that you're in your friends' closets, I think that people are just going to start choosing that just because it's easier and it makes sense and it saves money and it's actually it's in the end it's actually more fun to see your friends than click a lot online. I actually think it's kind of inevitable. The challenge is that we just don't yet have enough people kind of throwing themselves into it. And that's, I think, actually why the dialogue we're having today is so important and, what you're trying to bring about. Because we just, the way things are the way they are because we made rules to make them like this. And we have to change that. We've sort of changed that with recycling, right? That's been a step. Recycling didn't exist as a norm 30 years ago in America. And now in most places in the United States, people understand that you just don't throw away valuable resources. Well, reuse will similarly be a norm. In the same way that we spend lots of care buying things and bringing them to our home, we'll understand that maintaining those things and putting them into other people's hands will be similarly an important and kind of well-respected pathway for people.
You know, I've always thought that reduce, reuse, recycle, when I grew up, they were kind of, I would call them a feel-good slogan. And it seems like it's becoming an operating imperative for companies that are facing potential shortfalls in resources as they go forward. And what I hear you saying is that at the community level, at the household level, there's a number of benefits that can come from also making these imperatives. There could be people could be needing this for economic reasons, or they environmentally, this makes a lot of sense. But ultimately, I think that anything that reduces our use of resources, energy being the primary component that I build everything off of, but other ones as well, is those become things that those communities, those individuals, those companies, those nations that do it better, I think are much more resilient, durable, and potentially with a higher level of social and community engagement than those who aren't doing those sorts of activities. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. So, I mean, and again, this is the trend towards that pace. It's productivity per unit of energy. I mean, you look at the state of California, and it's radically increased its productivity per unit of energy. We basically use about the same amount of energy and water we did 30 years ago, but we're radically more productive as an economy. So I think that is the trend that we'll see. You know, our challenge is sort of making it happen. I mean, there's a couple kind of macro ideas in economics that are sort of on the fringes, but I think moving to the center. I mean, one is this idea of the circular economy that has been championed by Bill McDonough and Dame Ellen MacArthur in Britain, which suggests that we're moving from kind of the take-make-waste economy, you take something from the earth, you make it into something, you throw it away, mm-hmm. into a more circular economy where you take something, you make it into something else, and then you put it right back in the cycle. So the waste of one item becomes the feedstock for the next. The other idea is this idea of collaborative consumption or the sharing economy, where we're actually finding ways to with each other, consume items together. And really not, you don't really consume a baby stroller, but you in this case, encourage the creation of a better baby stroller that I can use and I can pass on to my sister and she can pass on to, you know, her brother-in-law and they can keep on moving. And that idea we're seeing in all sorts of different sectors. So we're seeing that with Zipcar, with car sharing. We're seeing that with Airbnb, with renting out your extra rooms instead of needing to build a new hotel. We're seeing that in information sharing with Wikipedia. We're seeing that, you know, in traffic data with Waze. So we're seeing lots of places where we're collectively coming together and making a resource much, much more effective and getting much more utility out of it by our kind of collective resourcefulness. And the third concept is, you know, what Bill McDonough calls cradle to cradle, but this idea that you're sort of thinking about a product throughout its entire life cycle. So when you make it, you think about, you know, do I actually need to sell this product ever, or can I actually sell this product as a service? I was just with the CEO of Ecolab, which is a 40,000-person company based in, a Fortune 500 company based in Minnesota. You know, and they basically lease, they're the biggest buyer of dishwashers in the world, and most restaurants that you eat in have a Ecolab dishwasher. They lease it to the restaurant. Restaurants fail all the time. If they fail, they take it back. They rent the dishwasher as a service to the company. So instead of each company having its own dishwashers that to sell at the end of the, you know, if they go out of business or if they move locations, Ecolab does it. And, you know, the best thing about Ecolab is that they push the manufacturers to make them better because it's in their interest to have a better functioning dishwasher that they don't have to go and service every week.
Aligned interests.
Aligned interests is exactly right, Chris. That's right.
Yeah, I was at a presentation, it was probably 3.5-4 years ago, where an engineer from Ricoh, you know, they make a lot of toners, cartridges, copiers, things like that, and they had a complete reduce, reuse, recycle thing, which wasn't just a loop where, you know, they took control of the toner cartridge, but they had multiple nested flows and loops because they were actually very concerned. This was the first presentation I've ever been to where an engineer from a company tossed up a resource graph and said, here's how much of these critical items we think are left in the earth, and we can no longer treat them as things that we pull out, use, and then no longer track where they end up, trusting that somehow they end up in the system. They felt they had to take responsibility for the flow of materials within their sphere of their universe. And I guess what I'm hearing you say is that at the individual level, we have opportunities to, again, sort of be responsible or have responsibility for the same sort of materials flows rather than thinking of them as just a one-way trip. It comes from somewhere and ends in the dump. We have to start really thinking about how we're going to increase their utility, really maximize their utility over time.
Yeah, and that, again, it's something that we can all begin in our own lives, in our own homes, as a way everyone could use to save a little bit of money and to reduce their clutter a lot. This is a great tactic to actually, you know, to both save resources for the planet, but also certainly save resources in your household budget. There's no reason we shouldn't be sharing more. And that, I mean, that is why we set up Yertl. It's basically just a sharing network, right? And, you just go to Yertl, Y-E-R-D-L-E, and you link it up with your Facebook page, and that then builds a network very quickly of your friends. And if you have something extra that you want to give away or share from camping equipment to skis or garden equipment, or kitchen, gear, you can put that up, or you can request things. So, I just watched a mom get a whole bunch of size 2, winter gear for her baby because they were going on a skiing trip. Just really simple stuff. You know, this is not, I'd like to say this is rocket science, but it's stuff that we've always done, but we haven't really, you know, we haven't culturally moved to the point where we do this regularly now because it's so easy to waste.
Interesting. So are these things that people are willing to part with, or is there some expectation that they'll be returned? Is this both a loan library, as it were, and a giveaway center, or is it one or the other?
So you can either give or loan. So I just loaned a kind of a camping carrier for the top of my car that I use 1 week a year, mm-hmm. And a friend of mine borrowed it. And it's great to have it being put to use. But about 90% of the things up on the site are free. So, you know, when people log in, where we first launched was San Francisco, and the average person who logs in finds 300 free things open to them, just items that their friends have put up that they're done with and would love their friends to have. They don't want to just sort of give to Salvation Army or just sort of throw away, but they actually think have value and they'd like a friend to have them. Because, you know, we all have those sort of special, meaningful things that are hard to part with, and those tend to mm-hmm. sort of clutter our lives. But it feels so good to put something like that into a friend's home when they move into a new apartment or move into a new home, or, you know, it's just a great way to connect with people as well.
Well, fantastic. What other services or capabilities are offered in Yertl?
Well, you know, the most important thing is just to build that sharing circle for yourself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you come online at Yertl.com and you link up with your friends, and then you post a few things that they might be interested in, or you ask what they might be looking for. And, you know, right now we're a very young network, so we're looking for people to pollinate or to basically spread the pollen around in their own community and help to grow it. But the other things that we're seeing that are kind of super interesting is that this connects into a wide variety of efforts that are happening across the world. One of the things that we were really inspired by was this saving circle movement that's kind of based in Dharavi, Mumbai. Dharavi is one of the largest slums in the world. It's where they film Slumdog Millionaire. But there's thousands and thousands of women who are involved in these local saving circles where, since they don't have access to banks, 20 women get together and they share items back and forth between themselves in groups of 20 people. They save money every day, they survey themselves, and they commit to spreading the word about this simple idea. And to date, there's tens of millions of women across the world, mostly in slums in Kenya, in Mexico City, in South Africa, in Brazil, who have formed these saving circles and are, you know, basically using their neighbors to solve their needs. And, you know, they're finding it's a really rapid way of both developing equity in their own, themselves, as well as kind of building these stronger relationships. So what we're doing with Yertl is part of a larger cultural movement to figure out how we can link ourselves together in a world that pulls us all apart, how we can find reasons to trust each other, and then how we can find reasons to stay connected. Because it's all good to have a neighborhood association. It's all good to sort of have it, but why? And, you know, what we say is that this is the way that you can both save money and get the things you need. It's a very practical reason to connect with people and also be able to have experiences that you may never have been able to afford. There's a bunch of people who just got kite surfing gear on Yertl because it turns out if you want to learn how to go kite surfing, which I suggest, you try, mm-hmm. You need a training kite, but you only need a training kite for the first few times and then you're set. So people put up their training kites, which they had bought, and said, you know, hey, why didn't someone else try these on? And it got a lot more people into the sport. So there's all sorts of different things. You can imagine the hobbies that you have, ways you could pass those hobbies on to your friends or to their kids. It's just a great way of passing that kind of information around to people as well.
It all sounds absolutely wonderful. And I know many of our listeners are going to be interested in this because we do have a very strong desire within our community to figure out how to increase those community connections. As you say, many of those have been We have a culture that's sort of trended towards isolation, and there's things that we can do and probably should do to start reversing that. And this sounds like a great way to begin to connect up electronically. And I'm sure there's a great need for that. I know there's interest. So I'm really looking forward to pushing that. And I have a surprise question for you here, which is, for people who are listening, Adam has the distinction of having gone to college with our own Adam Taggart, my business partner, co-founder of peakprosperity.com. And I hear from him that you do a mean cover of Centerfold by the Jay Giles band. So do you get to utilize that hidden talent much on the sustainability circuit?
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, what I was referring to is I was in an a cappella group in college, which called the Brown Derbies. We were able to tour the world singing songs. The best gig that got me is that we actually, after we graduated, went to Japan and worked as wedding singers for a summer, which was
fantastic.
Definitely demeaning work. But
what a learning experience, though.
Yes.
Well, Adam, thank you so much. I'm really excited to have talked with you and also get your thoughts on where we're really headed and that there are, I love hearing that there's sort of a groundswell of new movements going forward where we can at once tackle the major issues that we're reading about and experiencing on a daily basis and do it in a positive way, save money, increase community connections. I really support all of those basic trends. I think that's fantastic. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Well, and thanks so much for the community you're building. And this is how we're going to do it, piece by piece.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for your time.
My home angel, always been from my side. She was gold like snowflakes, no one could ever stain. Memory of my angel could never cause me pain. Years go by and I'm looking through a girly magazine, and there's my home angel on the pages in between. My blood runs cold, my memory has just died. Oh, my angel is a centerfold. I say my blood runs cold, and my memory has just been sold. Angel is a centerfold. Slimming notes under the desk while I was thinking about her chest. I was shy, I turned away before she caught my eye. And I was shaking in my shoes whenever she flashed those baby blues. Something got a hold of me and my angel passed close by. Those soft fuzzy sweaters, too magical to touch. To see her in that negligee is really just too much. My blood runs cold, my memory has just been sold. My angel is a centerfold. I said my blood runs cold, yeah, my memory has just been sold. Nah, angel is a centerfold. Well, it's okay, I understand. This ain't no never, never land. I hope that when this issue's gone, I'll see you when it does run. Take your car, yes, you will. Or take your car and drive it. Take it to a motel. Take them off and drive it. A part of me has just been ripped. The pages from my mind been stripped. Oh no, I can't deny it. Oh yeah, I guess I gotta buy it.
The run's cold.
My memory has just been sold. My angel is a centerfold. I say my blood runs cold. Yeah, my memory has just been sold. Nah, 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 nah. Angel is a centerfold. Nah.